From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Hope you had a wonderful week. Now, you won't hear it on this podcast, but we wanted to tell you that we gave our listeners a quiz on Friday. The Oxford and Merriam-Webster dictionaries decided to add more than 1,000 new words and phrases. Some of them are slang, words like humble brag and drunk text. We offered a little quiz to see how many new words and phrases you understand. So check out the podcast of Friday's second hour if you want to play along, or I've listed all the questions on my Twitter feed at mmacmedia.
A lot of fun. And this week, we're going to start with a conversation about how the wealthiest Americans use their money. For Chuck Collins, it was simple. He gave it all away.
Chuck Collins is the great-grandson of Oscar Mayer, and his family gave him $500,000 in an inheritance. At the age of 26 in 1985, Collins made national news by deciding to give it away. He tells his story in a new book, Born on Third Base, and he came to Rochester to talk about how to convince wealthy Americans to use their money for social causes.
The segment began with me asking Chuck when it was that he knew he was going to give away his entire family inheritance.
It may have started actually when I was seven, because I grew up in Detroit in a very, very wealthy suburb, and I could see the gap between where I lived and Detroit. But in my mid-20s, I actually had a job working with tenants in mobile home parks, and I was helping them. My job was to help them figure out how to buy their parks and own their mobile home parks. And actually, I got to work in upstate New York and other places as well. But what that gave me was this like intimate front row seat into low-income people's economic circumstances, just as wages were starting to stagnate in the 80s. And so I saw how people were taking on more work and working more hours and taking on debt just to survive. And coming from a wealthy family, I had this intimate front row seat in how wealth was starting to create more wealth. And that was really a key moment for me, was like, wow, I'm not sure I want to be part of this system that is compounding wealth and advantage for people like me. So that was really kind of the moment when I think I thought, you know, I think I'm going to move the gift along and make my own way.
And, you know, you write about how so many people in the wealthiest brackets in this country, and often their descendants, their kids, and I don't mean this in a way that is sneering, it's just an observation, and I think that's what you do in the book pretty well, is you say there's a lot of discussion that, well, we made the right decisions, and if the other people who are poorer or not as wealthy or don't have the same means just made better decisions, because it's a way of convincing yourself we've earned it. And of course we have this much money, we've earned it. Something in your life was different. I mean, was it the way you were raised? Was there an experience? Or was it, as you say, that work that you were doing in your mid-20s when you kind of got to see it up close, the way people struggled, the pride they had in community? How do you think it was that kind of shaped you?
Well, I think that whatever the mythology of deservedness just didn't stick for me. I mean, first of all, I was literally born on third base. I mean, I can only claim that I picked the right parents in that case. You know, I picked wealthy parents. Otherwise, it was just clear I won the lottery. And there was a story in our family about how the family had, you know, been a successful family over four generations, but I had no part in that. And I was meeting people who were working extremely hard. So the story just didn't work for me. The kind of I couldn't adopt a you know, I somehow have a claim on this wealth. It just didn't stick.
And you didn't want to give away half? You know, I mean, like, you're going to give away the whole thing.
Well, for me, it was a deep desire to kind of make it on my own without something that happened in the past. Now, the moment I gave that wealth away, I actually thought I was taking this enormous leap. Here's the reality, Evan, is I have a mountain of other advantages that are kind of almost hardwired into my life. I mean, four generations of economic stability in a family, social networks, access to healthcare. I'm white, I'm male. I mean, I have this enormous wind at my back that is just kind of wired into my life.
Even without $500,000 in
there. Yeah, so I didn't really fully understand. I mean, I don't have to worry about my parents, you know.
And by the way, what did your dad say about this?
Well, you know, I wrote my parents a letter when I had made this decision to pass this money along, and they, you know, they were understandably concerned, as any parent would be. But my dad said, you know, listen, have you thought this through? You're young, you're in your 20s. What if you someday have a child and that child has a special need? Or what if you have a partner, spouse, and that person gets ill? Wouldn't you wish you had that cushion of money? And my response was, well, then I would be in the same boat as 99% of all the people I know. I would have to get help. To which he said, well, you would ultimately have to fall back on government, and that's a lousy safety net. To which I said, well, wouldn't I have a stake in maybe making that a better safety net? To which he said, oi, you're so idealistic, you know?
Next, let's turn to International Women's Day. Specifically, Assistant Public Defender Danielle Ponder wanted to focus on how women of color suffer from unequal treatment in the criminal justice system.
Ponder gave a public presentation at Nazareth College about this, but first she joined us on Connections to explain what she's witnessed in her work.
Issues in the criminal justice system should be at the forefront of the feminist movement. It really should get much more attention because it affects the lives of women. The women who posted on my page and said, my 16-year-old son was taken in. First of all, as people of color, we live in a very matriarchal society where many women are raising children by themselves. So when a black boy is taken into custody because he had no bell on his bike and then maybe he had marijuana on him, that affects a black woman. So the criminal justice system, because black women are the matriarchs of our society, they're constantly affected by high incarceration rate, whether even if it's not themselves, incarceration rates of black men. And I do want to get this last thing out, Evan, something that's more directly to International Women's Day and to feminism is the criminalization of black motherhood. And I don't think this is something I've talked to you about on your show, but we often get a charge in criminal court endangering the welfare of a child. And that is often African-American women who are charged with that. And most of the time, it is because they left their child alone for an unknown period of time. So I've had a client who was dropped off, had to go to work. So her husband left the child sleeping, went to work. I had a client who was in the backyard on the phone and the child was in the house. These women, it's not seen, the problem is not that they're bad mothers. The problem is that we don't have access to affordable child care, right? And so poor women are often left taking care of their children by themselves and have to figure out how to go to work, how to do different things, and at the same time care for their children. So instead of seeing that as an issue, we criminalize them as bad mothers. And this is not happening in Pittsburgh. A woman in Pittsburgh does not go to the backyard and make a phone call, come back in, and the police are there to arrest her. That doesn't happen. So that's something I'll talk about at the talk as well.
Is there a cascading effect to their lives when that happens, that kind of a charge happens?
Yes. I mean, it's a criminal charge. They can face jail time. Sometimes judges issue orders of protection so they can't see their children. But, you know, I don't want to go too deep in it, but there is this belief that black mothers are inherently bad mothers. And that's a belief that is codified into this country's legacy. It's almost part of the cognitive dissonance that this country had to go through. In order to take a child away from an African woman, you had to believe that that African woman just was not a good parent or even a human being. In order for slave masters to do that, they had to develop these stereotypes in their head, right? And so that still lives on today, that an officer believes inherently you are not a good mother. We don't know if you left your child for 5 minutes. We don't know if you left your child for 2 minutes. But there is a belief that black women are inherently bad mothers and that black men are inherently criminal. And that's codified in our institutions, and it affects the way that we treat them in the criminal justice system.
We've talked a lot about Standing Rock and the Dakota Access Pipeline. This week, we learned about a kind of Latin American equivalent. The Sarayaku people of Ecuador have been battling the government and oil companies for 20 years. That's because one day in 1996, helicopters showed up in their land, in the jungle, and men with guns explained they had a permit to come take the oil.
But the Sarayaku have been winning their battle, in contrast to the tribes who have been struggling with oil pipeline development at Standing Rock. One of our guests was Patricia Gualinga, a representative of the Sarayaku. She explained why the fight at Standing Rock could take years and why allies can't expect quick results. You're going to hear her first, and her comments are then translated by Paola Macas Bechart from the Rochester Committee on Latin America.
Yo creo que los pueblos indígenas hemos luchado mucho más años, no solo con las petroleras, sino contra todo lo que se nos ha venido encima de nuestros territorios y de nuestros derechos. Y todavía vamos a seguir luchando, y lo bueno es que estamos conscientes de eso. Pero sobre todo, estamos conscientes de que ya nuestra lucha no es solo por los derechos de los pueblos indígenas, sino por el derecho de una sobrevivencia del planeta. Y ese va a ser nuestro aporte fundamental a la humanidad, la sobrevivencia de este planeta Tierra.
So, yeah, I must say that indigenous peoples in Ecuador and around the world, we've been fighting not just 10 years, but many, many years. Mm-hmm. And not just, we're not been fighting just the oil companies, but we've been fighting all the abuses of our fundamental rights. And we are going to keep fighting because we know that we have to keep fighting and resisting. And now we know that our fight is not just for our territories and our livelihoods. We are fighting for the world because now we know that it's really, we have to fight, otherwise we won't survive in this planet.
How important is it to have allies who don't give up after a year or 2 years, to have allies from different backgrounds who are not indigenous people, but see the struggle and want to be there and don't expect to go, whether it's to Standing Rock or whether it's going to Ecuador, and to think, well, I took one or two trips, how come things didn't change? How important is it to have allies for a long time in this kind of struggle?
Es muy importante porque nos unen los problemas, nos une la espiritualidad, nos une la cultura y nos une la inspiración de no rendirse. Y eso es importante, saber que acá están luchando en Standing Rock, que Sarayaco está luchando, que están luchando en el Ártico y que todos estamos unidos y que todos pensamos igual, aunque en diferentes idiomas y en diferentes contextos. Y eso es inspirador para todos y sobre todo en este momento que hay una crisis mundial sobre el cambio climático y que en la cual nosotros vamos a hacer el aporte fundamental como pueblos indígenas protegiendo a la madre tierra en el primer frente y lo estamos haciendo.
This is very important because we are united. We just probably have different problems, but we are united by culture, by the inspiration, because Standing Rock is fighting and other peoples are fighting, and we know that we are together in the fight, and that's very inspiring that Standing Rock is fighting and people in the Arctic are fighting, we are fighting, and we know that even if we have different languages, we are together in this fight, and this is particularly important these days because we are living a global crisis on climate change, and I think that what we offer as indigenous peoples is really to share the message of protecting Mother Earth, and that's our biggest thing that we can give to this world and the movement.
Yo creo que los pueblos indígenas hemos luchado mucho más años, no solo con las petroleras, sino contra todo lo que se nos ha venido encima de nuestros territorios y de nuestros derechos. Y todavía vamos a seguir luchando, y lo bueno es que estamos conscientes de eso. Pero sobre todo, estamos conscientes de que ya nuestra lucha no es solo por los derechos de los pueblos indígenas, sino por el derecho de una sobrevivencia del planeta. Y ese va a ser nuestro aporte fundamental a la humanidad, la sobrevivencia de este planeta Tierra.
So, yeah, I must say that indigenous peoples in Ecuador and around the world, we've been fighting not just 10 years, but many, many years. Mm-hmm. And we're not been fighting just the oil companies, but we've been fighting all the abuses of our fundamental rights. And we are going to keep fighting because we know that we have to keep fighting and resisting. And now we know that our fight is not just for our territories and our livelihoods. We are fighting for the world because now we know that it's really, we have to fight, otherwise we won't survive in this planet.
How important is it to have allies who don't give up after a year or 2 years, to have allies from different backgrounds who are not indigenous people, but see the struggle and want to be there and don't expect to go, whether it's to Standing Rock or whether it's going to Ecuador, and to think, well, I took one or two trips, how come things didn't change? How important is it to have allies for a long time in this kind of struggle?
Es muy importante porque nos unen los problemas, nos une la espiritualidad, nos une la cultura y nos une la inspiración de no rendirse. Y eso es importante, saber que acá están luchando en Standing Rock, que Sarayaco está luchando, que están luchando en el Ártico y que todos estamos unidos y que todos pensamos igual, aunque en diferentes idiomas y en diferentes contextos. Y eso es inspirador para todos y sobre todo en este momento que hay una crisis mundial sobre el cambio climático y que en la cual nosotros vamos a hacer el aporte fundamental como pueblos indígenas protegiendo a la madre tierra en el primer frente y lo estamos haciendo.
This is very important because we are united. We just probably have different different problems, but we are united by culture, by the inspiration, because Standing Rock is fighting and other peoples are fighting, and we know that we are together in the fight, and that's very inspiring that Standing Rock is fighting and people in the Arctic are fighting, we are fighting. And we know that even if we have different languages, we are together in this fight. And this is particularly important these days because we are living a global crisis on climate change. And I think that what we offer as indigenous peoples is really to share the message of protecting Mother Earth. And that's our biggest thing that we can give to this world and the movement.
Finally, this week, we also talked about comedy and the deep emotions behind it. You might have heard the phrase, there's truth in every joke. Well, sometimes that truth comes from dark places, deep emotions, and personal struggle. Stars like Robin Williams, Sarah Silverman, and Ellen DeGeneres have been outspoken about how anxiety, depression, and other mental health issues have fueled their material.
We talked to three local stand-up comedians about how they address mental health in their acts and how sometimes it's a challenge to make audiences comfortable with being uncomfortable. You'll hear from Andrea Springer and Kyle Baker, but first, here's Kelsey Claire Hagen about how some people have reacted to her material about sexual abuse and PTSD.
I've had some men be mad at me. There's a whole Reddit thread about me, about my show, about things I've said. I think it's reactive. I think that there is definitely a great conversation that I could have with somebody, that guy included, that like was like, sex and rape are the same thing, and they're not. Tell me not. I think there's a great conversation we could have that he could learn a lot. Maybe I could even learn a lot. But, you know, I think right now people are just very ready to like rage, you know, and I think that goes for both sides of the spectrum. But
are men, generally speaking, more fragile?
Yeah, when it comes to, I mean, just in like what you're asking me right now, I'm sorry.
But
like, I mean, more easily offended, more. Yeah. Offended. You can't say this about, you can't.
Yeah.
You get
no,
more of that
definitely.
From men.
Okay. Yeah, because I mean, what we're talking about right now is like a triggering PTSD. Like I could relive one of the worst things that's ever happened to me because of a joke somebody said, and they're like, well, you really need to calm down about it. But then if I say something like, well, all men, they're like, that was really hurtful. It's like, are you serious? Like, it's all about paradigms and again, complexity. So, yeah, in my experience, yes, definitely. Certain men more so than not. But.
Okay. Andrea?
I don't get that often. I don't get people saying that my stuff is over the line. I do get a lot of, like, that really happened to you? And then, like, I'm so sorry. And I'm like, this is not the conversation I want to have after a comedy show.
Do you tell people that, or do you say thanks?
Yeah, I do. I tell people that it's all real. It's all based on stuff that's happened. But then I try to be like, isn't that like funny? As opposed to like, I'm very traumatized.
If I could, I don't mean to interrupt, but the best is when a guy comes up to you and he feels really sad for you, and like he feels for you, but you're almost then consoling him your
like
horrible
him feeling bad
all the time.
Like,
it's
gonna be okay. Like women are raped every day, but like you're gonna be fine. Like it's crazy.
You like have an out of body experience. Like what am I doing with this person here?
Right.
You're just why am I? Yeah. Okay. Kyle, what do you think?
I've never actually had somebody come up to me with regard to like talking about. I think maybe somebody like what Andrew said, be like, wow, you're really, that's really good what you're going through right now. But yeah, I mean, again, I try to present what I'm going through in a very relatable way with maybe some dark twists or really silly twists just to kind of get everybody on the same page. So I'm not really, you know, stepping over a line or, I mean, because I talk about anxiety and depression, I think definitely with PTSD, you could definitely potentially trigger somebody. But with what I talk about, I mean, the closest would probably be if I'm joking about self-harm, but that's just because I've gone through that kind of stuff. So I feel comfortable making fun of it because it's something I struggle with.
And that does it for this edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
You can also hear us on the WXXI mobile app. Have a great weekend, everybody.